All right, I just hit the record button and Mick, let's continue on with your great presentation on private data objects where we left off and get the deep dive.
All right, there's no way in the world we'll get through everything on this time, so I want to just sort of skim along on it. So a couple of things just as reminders from last time. First is that what we're basically talking about is taking some data, wrapping a smart contract around it, pushing it into a trusted execution environment. The pieces of PDO, the four important pieces of it, are the contract enclaves and the enclave services that wrap that, which are, where all the interesting stuff happens for executing the smart contracts.
Mick, do you mind just calling out the slide number so that
Okay, that's fine. Can you see my screen? Because I'm sharing off the PowerPoint rather than the Google version of it. Because I like Google Slides, but unless you start with Google Slides, moving back and forth between PowerPoint and Google Slides is nearly impossible. So I will push any modifications I make back up to that presentation that's online. All right, that being said, so I'm on slide 10 right now. Just the architecture, there are basically four pieces, and we're going to talk a little bit about how these four pieces fit together. Contract enclaves do the execution of the smart contracts inside a trusted execution environment. Our current PDO architecture is our current PDO implementation is on Intel SGX. In theory, in particular, for the contract enclaves, for a variety of requirements that we would have, there are potentially alternative TEEs that could be used for that. So the concept is independent of the TEE, but the implementation details are definitely specific to Intel SGX. Second piece is the distributed storage services, and we are not requiring contract state to be stored forever. The storage services are not there to support long-term persistence. They're simply there as a means of processing notifications so that interested clients can pick up changes. We'll talk about that later. The contract provisioning services is really about how we use an MPC multi-party computation in order to generate an encryption key that can be shared across the contract enclaves. And then the ledger is really the part that handles kind of the commitment of transactions and enforces sort of the high-level policy. Note that the ledger has no smart contract semantics whatsoever. It really is just a commit log for it. It may do some ordering, but the ordering, rather than being linear ordering, is really a DAG-based ordering, which allows us to do some coordination between contracts. Architectural principles, I think this is where we basically left off last time. Ledger is a root of trust, but it is not semantically aware. So it tells us what the current state of a particular contract object is and commits to policies. We do separation of execution and authority. Now, again, I'll talk about this in a minute. That separation of execution and authority, which we borrowed from Fabric as an idea, as a concept, allows for some really nice scalability. We designed for trustless, which means that the security principles that we have should be there, should allow us to do sort of worst case threat models, Byzantine threat models. But we have, as often as possible, architected in a way that allows for less aggressive threat models to provide opportunities for optimization for it. State is always encrypted, and in particular, the owner of the keys for decrypting state is the contract object itself, or the enclaves that have been provisioned for that contract object. No human being has those keys unless the contract specifically allows the human being to have those keys. Most motivated party is going to be in charge of everything. And this goes back to kind of like the replication service where, the clients who are participating in the contract are the ones that care the most about persisting the state for as long as it needs to be persisted. Let them deal with it. So we try to get the infrastructure out of the way, use it for coordination. The infrastructure is principally about coordination and authority, but it is not about core services. Security, there's a whole other talk on this. I'm not going to go into a lot about this, but the point is really about no big targets, and a model of trust and verify on it. So for confidentiality, we require explicit provision. There's no key that allows you to unlock the entire system. Integrity, we do again sort of a implementation of trustless, but allow for optimization. There's a notion of a commit on one, revoke on n, which allows us to commit a transaction on the save a single enclave, although for those interested parties, for those most motivated, they can provide a verification process or verification step in there that allows for revocation of a transaction for it. Okay, so that's basically design principles. So this is where we ended last time. Let me just stop and ask questions before we continue. All right. So there are a bunch of things. So I've really organized this kind of around pods. And if you had a chance to look through it and there are particular pods that you would like to go through, let's make sure we prioritize those. So let me just first and foremost ask the question, are there sort of areas that are burning on people's minds? Because we're not going to have an opportunity to go through. Well, it's unlikely we'll have an opportunity to go through everything in spite of the fact that I talk crazy fast sometimes. So in looking through this, were there areas that you specifically wanted to make sure we touch on?
Scalability seems very interesting. One.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is about this contextual security or contextual sort of consensus situation.
The commit and coordination log.
Yeah, what I mean is that you have some kind of a dial around that thing to have in the architectural principles. You said that in a completely trustless situation, dial it up. In other situations, dial it down. More on that would be great.
All right, I'll talk a little bit about that. What else?
Well, you know, the question that keeps on coming back is about the integrity of the TEs, which you did go into a little bit with Clive's question the other time, with respect to the various published attacks.
Okay.
So related to that, it seems to be a little bit of a trade-off between privacy protection and correctness protection with the multiple TEs. So maybe you can talk a little bit about the model there and what's protected and what's not.
Okay. So those don't match quite to the pods, but I'll try to make sure that I come back and address all of those. The TE integrity issues, Vipin, that's a completely separate, fairly substantial talk. I'd recommend that we hold on that one a bit. If you want to come back to it, we can come back to it.
We have discussed this earlier, maybe a year ago, 2 years ago, when all those attacks were published. And I'm pretty satisfied that there are guards against it. But they have to be turned on, like turning off hyper-threading, for example, or something else. I don't know.
Yep.
All those things. The actual ways in which you can protect.
Yeah, there are mitigations at the hardware level that make it more and more robust to side channel attacks. And the kind of core principles that we have in designing PDO has focused on design with the assumption that compromise is possible and make it as hard as we can and hard and expensive as we can to compromise some specific contract. So that's sort of the we call it internally this notion of design for compromise. that the protocols should be able to tolerate that. But because the TEE makes it really hard and expensive to do those attacks, we can then be optimistic in our execution. So I would suggest we hold off, and I can come back and we can do a full talk on how that works and what our approach is for that, if you're okay with that.
Of course I'm okay with that.
Okay. You get a whole day to yourself on that. How could that be a bad thing?
Well, it's not just me. I'm sure there are a lot of people who are asking that question.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I think I'm going to add, let me make sure that I come to as many of those as I can on this. There's some things we can probably skip through. So let's just jump to starting slide 15 and just talk a little bit about the scalability and where the scalability comes from when you're using TEEs and the approach that we have on it. So slide 16 then is just sort of, this is when we do smart contracts today, this is the sort of approach. The basic principle for resiliency is that we get it through redundant computation. So where we used to have trust in a single organization, now we spread that trust over community, and the community basically takes the approach of, we're all going to execute this because we don't trust anybody else. And then we'll all collect the results together, and those results constitute a vote. And if we all voted the same way, then we accept the answer as the correct answer. So whether this is, in public Ethereum and you have 20,000 validators, which means that your little CryptoKitty application is going to run on 20,000 servers, makes for an incredibly resilient computation, very hard to break it. But at the same time, it's a little skewed in that the CryptoKitty creation operations and probably don't need the cost of computation spread over 20,000 servers that way. A similar example is the endorsement policy in Fabric. And the idea behind the endorsement policy is we ask several peers to perform a computation. They generate and sign a change set that comes out of that computation. And if all of the change set matches, or enough of the change set matches, then I can put together a package that I hand to the ordering service and say, you should commit this transaction, and here's my proof that I met the requirements for the endorsement policy. And it's that consistency of the identity of the change sets. And so the change set hash essentially becomes the vote for the output. And so again, we're using redundancy here in order to substitute for a lack of institutional trust. Either way, this sort of principle of redundancy, even in situations like the endorsement policy where you have some control over right sizing the amount of redundancy, is still very inefficient, right? You're replacing what you used to do on one computer with something you're doing on 13 or 20,000 or whatever it is, depending on the policies that you have on it. And the second observation about that is that everyone, the more redundancy you require, the more you expose the information that's associated with the contract to organizations who are performing that validation or performing that computation. So if I require a lot of resiliency, I require a lot of redundancy, and that means that the surface of those who have access to my information continues to grow. So we end up in a situation where everything is public, at least to the set of validators that are participating in the transaction. It's inefficient, and in general, because of the coordination required, it tends to be kind of slow. So the idea behind the TEE is that we can replace that single organization with hardware-based trust. We do the smart contract based on the TEE. The trusted execution environment executes the contract once in an enclave, produces the proof of correctness. And what the validators are doing is, rather than executing the contract and verifying the results, they're really just verifying that the integrity of the enclave and the proof that the enclave generated for that. So you end up requiring a lot less redundancy. And you know, Vipin, this is where it comes back. You don't really remove the redundancy, but the optimistic execution approach, it does allow us to do optimistic execution. And I'll talk about that in just a second. But basically, we're coming back to single server computations, and that single server computation is happening in a trusted execution environment, which prevents even the host from looking at the data that's a part of that computation. So we end up having some notion of privacy or confidentiality. It's much more efficient, or has the potential for being much more efficient. And the scalability parts I'll talk about in just a minute.
From our last time, I understood that there are still multiple TEEs that execute the contract. So how does that map to multiple organizations, if at all?
Let me describe how PDO works in this case. The policy that we have, and I'm sorry I don't have the slides on this. This is, like I said, this is part of a separate talk that I do, and I didn't suck all of that material into this one. The policy we have in PDO is what we call commit on one, revoke on n. So the idea is that we can be optimistic because the TEE at a minimum makes it very hard to attack. That doesn't mean that it's impossible, but it does mean that it's hard. If we can design the protocols, and we believe we have, in a way that prevents kind of scalable attacks. That is, you compromise one node and that gives you the information you need to compromise all nodes, right? Which makes the attack much cheaper. So assuming that we've done that correctly, and we believe we have with the approach that we take, then we can be optimistic on the commits. So if a single TEE says, I've performed a computation, and the computation is that I had an initial input state, I performed a computation on it, and it generated an output state. Right, so it's really just a state transformation that we're capturing. And we can go through the invocation pieces in a minute. In fact, that's something I'd like to jump down to, because I know Hart's going to ask me questions about how that works. So that's the state transition. So I can commit that to the ledger. But one of the things that we do is that computation, the result of that computation, is actually embedded inside the state of the object. So any other organization that wants to verify the integrity of what that TEE did can grab the resulting state, hand that the initial state and the resulting state to another TEE that's been provisioned. And that TEE that other TEE that has been provisioned can do a verify operation. And the verify operation basically extracts the message, or extracts the computation that was performed, applies it to the initial state, and then compares the result with the state that was generated. So the initial computation is, you know, it's basically take the original state, the message, and that's sent to the contract, execute it and generate the state. In this case, rather than the user sending the message, because the message is private and confidential, we grab the message out of the encrypted state and then reapply it and then verify that the transformation that we just did generates the same results. Does that make sense?
So looks like there is a separate verification stage, which is separate from the validation, and that's working on a revoke model. Does that lead to some potential inconsistency between a revocation, between a commit and a revocation?
There is a potential for it, yes. But the period between the initial commit and when evidence must be presented that we should revoke is part of the contract policy that's committed to at the beginning. So anyone who wants to verify that a commit will not ever be revoked just has to wait that well-defined period.
Got it.
Right. So we basically say, hey, you're going to have, you know, this contract is a low value contract. It's low risk. So the policy that I want for this is, you know, I'm going to commit it in two blocks, right? So you got two blocks on the blockchain in order to provide evidence that a transaction came from a compromised TEE. Okay. At the other end of the spectrum, I might say, hey, this thing's handling high value and it's high risk. I want to make sure that we have time to do the verification, that anyone who cares about the verification, and this is where I'll come back and answer your optimistic question, Vipin, anyone who cares about the result of that computation will have time to do a verification of it. So I'm going to say that we're going to wait 10 blocks. And in that 10 block period, if you provide evidence of revocation, then we can do the revocation for it. So it becomes policy, right? So this goes back to, you know, we allow you to design for trustless. You could make that revocation period as long as you wanted. But we also allow you to optimize for what you really believe based on your trust. So the policies and what you care about for the characteristics of the transaction and the characteristics of the contract, you can make the decision based on the policies, or you can set the policies based on what you care about. So back to the optimistic, pessimistic thing. The infrastructure does not do the verification, right?
Got it.
We don't do the verification. Somebody else who's participating in the contract can do the verification. So let's say, Ram, that you commit a transaction to the ledger. Vipin's a part of this contract and cares pretty deeply about making sure that its integrity is matched. Vipin can go off and say, okay, I saw that someone committed this change. I know that this is a really high value thing and I want to make sure that the integrity is matched. So Vipin goes to a contract enclave service and says, please verify the computation that was done. So the one who cares about it is the one who's responsible. If Vipin cares about the integrity of the computation, then it's Vipin's responsibility to ensure that the verification takes place.
Sounds great, except one small problem. One is, obviously, if I'm basing my second transaction on the committed state of the first transaction, and if I am somewhat skeptical, then yeah, I mean, I may not do the second transaction until I go through these steps.
Yep, which slows things. Yeah, which potentially slows things down.
Yes, that's not the only point. The other point is that if there is somebody else who did verify and work on the second transaction, depending on the first. And subsequently, I mean, and then goes through the whole thing and probably gets even confirmed. Subsequently, there is a revocation of the first transaction.
How it cascades through the graph can be very difficult. So let me just make a couple of other observations about this, which is kind of unique here, right? So if you're in Fabric, and one of your peers generates a different answer than the others, what can you assume?
Endorsing peer or
yeah, I've my endorsement policy requires me to get five peers to give me an answer. Four of the peers generate one change set, and the fifth peer generates a different change set.
Then my endorsement policy fails, and I don't even see the ordering.
Yeah, okay. Sorry. Then let me just say that I only need three out of five in order to give the same answer. But one of them says something different, regardless of what the policy is for acceptance. I have four peers that say one thing and one peer that says something different.
I can just collect the endorsement set, right? That's fine.
Yeah, you can collect the endorsement set, but what does that say about the peer?
It's a faulty peer is what
It's a faulty peer, but we don't know why it's faulty, yeah. Right? So with a TEE, if one TEE says one thing and another TEE says another thing on what is intended to be a deterministic computation, then we start with the assumption that it's been compromised. That is, the claim that we can make if we come up with a different answer, is much stronger in the case of the TEEs.
Well, how do we know the input wasn't different, or it wasn't because the same thing?
Because we can verify that as part of the, that's verified as part of the execution.
Okay.
I'll come to that in the invocation in a minute, right? But the,
yeah,
the
right.
signature is over the input, the output, the method that was performing the
contract. Okay, yeah, you're right. You can handle that with...
So the point is that with the TEE, if you ever get in a situation where I can revoke a contract, then I can blacklist that TEE and I can taint any contract that has gone through that TEE. So I can make a much stronger statement, and my response to this kind of inconsistency can be much stronger as a result of knowing that there's a TEE underneath it. We have not explored all of the ideas that we have for doing
that. So the general principle here is that sort of what I think you're getting at, and tell me if this is right or wrong, mm-hmm. is that you can sort of selectively shard, right? Yep. Important transactions, I can like make most of the network or the whole network see. And like if I'm buying a $2 coffee, well, who cares, right?
Yep.
So I guess my question is, how are you doing this sharding? Are you doing it... do I get to choose who verifies my transactions, or do I say like, this is a minimum set? You know, does the network enforce some sort of randomness in who verifies the transactions? You know, that might be a good thing. Maybe if I've compromised like three TEs, you don't want me sending a transaction to be verified to like the three TEs I've compromised.
Yes. So I generally don't use the word sharding here. It helps conceptually because you can map it into stuff that we sort of understand. Every contract is explicitly provisioned, and we can jump. Let me just hold off and answer that question in a minute, if that's okay.
All right, that's fine. Right. Yeah.
There are two things I want to get through queued up here, and we'll talk about that in a second.
Yeah, it's not a super critical question. So
okay,
you're
moving down the right path, right? That is, there's the infrastructure doesn't do the sharding. When I create the contract, I pick the places that I want it, to be executed at.
Well, you probably want the infrastructure to do some of the sharding.
In this case, no, we don't do any of it.
Really? Because you want, you probably want at some point the users not to be able to pick all of the nodes, right? You want some independent nodes verifying.
There is no, remember, there's no verification except for what you request for it. All contracts are opt-in, right? Which means that if I start an auction, let's say that I'm going to create an auction over here, the commitment to the policies, including the provisioning policy, is public. So you get to decide whether or not you want to participate in the auction. If the auction is for, you know, 5 red marbles, you probably don't care a whole lot, right? But if it's for $1 million bid on wireless spectrum, then you can go back and look at and see, okay, that the enclaves on which, or the TEEs on which this contract can be executed are hosted at Google, Azure, and IBM. I can trust those. But if I come back and I look at that and say, okay, there's $1 million transaction that's going to be taking place. Some of them are at Google, some of them are at IBM, but a bunch of them are at the Stanford Grad Lab. I might look at that and say, I don't really want to put $1 million bid in that because my risk is too great on it. So the policies are completely exposed for provisioning. And you as a participant in the contract can interrogate those policies. You get to decide how you establish trust in the contract. That's really the critical point here, is the infrastructure does not decide. We'll help you, right? I mean, we provide all of the information. We give you the authoritative commitment to the policy. We make sure that the policy is enforced. We do enforcement of the policy, but you get to decide whether the policy matches your risk profile. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this particular move seems to put a dial there and make it from a deterministic consensus into some form of probabilistic consensus, depending on the risk?
It's not, the consensus isn't probabilistic. It's my participation in a particular contract that's based on
the finality of the result that I depend on. I mean,
we can get finality, but we get finality that there is a period where a transaction may be revoked. But let me just remind you that revocation means that a TEE was compromised. And really, if something gets revoked, you're done with that contract. I mean, our approach on revocation is we freeze the contract and there are no updates that are allowed. So there is a notification that's generated and we basically handle the exception at the institutional administrative level. So we blacklist the enclave so that no more updates will be accepted on the enclave and no more updates will be accepted from any contract that's provisioned for that enclave that's just been revoked. So we do very draconian measures when something's been compromised. And we just basically punt it.
What if it's the only truth teller in the whole bunch?
What's that?
What if it is the only truth teller in the whole bunch?
Then the notification that it's been revoked can be handled externally. But that is, we don't decide who's right. What we simply do is to say, somebody who's a part of this is a bad actor, and they're working hard to compromise the system.
Vipin, in that case, your whole blockchain assumption is totally broken, and you get no guarantees.
Yeah, it's like having an endorsement policy where you require five, and in fact, you've got seven compromised endorsers, endorsing peers. You know, you're just screwed, and there's nothing you can do about it. So, and that's why I'm saying is that what we can do is, because we know this is a TEE, if there is disagreement about the answer, we can say, screw it, we got to get the people involved. And so everything can be frozen because we have explicit provisioning. We know exactly who's part of each of the enclaves and we can halt execution.
And so within the TEE model is that there could be no other faults? Is that the assumption?
The assumption that we're making is because we know that the code is exactly the same based on the attestations that the TEE has generated, because we know that code is exactly the same, the configuration of the hardware is exactly the same, we better compute, and all of our processes are deterministic, right? Randomness is all taken care of in the initialization of the state, right?
Okay.
So everything is totally deterministic. So one of the things that might happen, if you've got two endorsing peers, you may have, for example, different versions of your Docker container.
Yeah, that's
right. Somebody's running an old version,
your interpreters, right? Your environment,
yep.
Whatever.
What we get from the TEE and the attestation of the integrity of the TEE is verification that that one and that one are exactly the same.
Okay. So the environment needs to be completely deterministic. That includes whatever infrastructure, your interpreter, everything.
And the advantage of running inside, for us, the advantage of using Intel SGX is because it's based on this notion of a small TCB. So you don't get to reach out and do IO out of a contract.
Okay.
Right. It is deterministic. In that sense, I mean, this is sort of the basic principles that we've had since Ethereum started this crazy idea years ago.
Okay, maybe at some other time you can describe what does it mean from practical perspective. What are the type of smart contract engines? What's the interpreter, so forth?
Yep, and it really the. A smart contract is really a transformation function. I mean, we've been talking about whether or not, if I say function as a service, are you familiar with that concept?
Yes.
Okay, so think of these smart contracts as Lambda functions.
Okay.
So there's some data that's associated with it. They take some input, they generate some output, and they change their state. And so there's a really simple model for execution on that. And we'll come to that in the invocation itself. Let me move a little faster on this. For the scalability thing, really, this is where I was going to say. So I'm on slide 19 for the recorders. The advantage of the fabric architecture is separating commitment from contract execution, or commitment from endorsement in their case, or ordering from endorsement in their case, means that we can put essentially arbitrary amounts of compute into the contract execution. And we took the same basic idea that the contract enclaves, all semantics, all storage happens in the contract enclaves. The ledger then is only about commitment. For us, it's a little bit more than ordering. We have to commit to the policy. So there's a registry function, which is just basically, here's a chunk of data, register this data, right? Timestamp this data. I register an attestation or verification for an enclave. I can register a policy for provisioning a contract, and all that stuff goes in there. But really what it's about is ordering the updates. And there's a whole section in here on how we do that. But separating out the commitment and the contract enclaves means that we can do arbitrarily complex computation in the contract enclaves, so long as it preserves that deterministic concept. So, okay. So we can make contracts arbitrarily complex. The hard part, as the consensus piece, is fully separated out and is a fixed function service. All right. Skip through the contract interpreters. You guys can go back and look at that separately. So let me just jump to the invocation. So slide 29 now. So this is the basic flow, and we'll build complexity into this in order to get the rest of the pieces of it. But this is the basic flow. So the contract participant pushes the current state of the contract to the contract enclave service, and then does an invocation. The invocation is the hash of the input state, and that hash is the identifier for contract state, for a state. It's a message that will be sent to the contract. It's a hash of the contract code that's associated with the contract, the identity of the contract participant, and this special thing that we call the channel key. The channel key is necessary for Sawtooth, but for CCF, it's actually not necessary for a variety of reasons. But the channel key just basically allows us to do anonymous submissions to the ledger for it. So the enclave computes the transaction, sends the result back, the results include the new state and the value that's computed for it. That set of changes is then pushed out to the ledger. So what you get as a transaction on the CCL is the hash of the input state, hash of the output state, hash of the message, hash of the result, hash of the contract code, and the channel key. And the channel key is what we use to sign that transaction. All right, pretty straightforward. Oh yeah, by the way, there's signatures all through this, and I'll talk about those in a minute. Bunch of crazy definitions, you can go through it. Bunch of crazy formalisms on 31. Some of those I'm using in this and some of them I'm not. So down to 32, just a little bit more detail about what actually goes into the method invocation. So this is sort of blowing it up as to what actually is going in. So when we do the invocation, we're passing in the hash of the encrypted state. And this is actually a hash of the root block of the Merkle tree that we use to store state. So that gets us a unique identifier for the state. And the important thing about that is that identifier can be self-verified. So if you give me the hash as the identity, then I can verify that the block I have corresponds to the hash that I was given for it. There's a method invocation that's a part of this. We hash the contract code, but one of the things that we do on contract initialization is we actually take the contract code and store it in state. So the state becomes a complete serialization of the contract object. The hash of the contract code allows the enclave to verify that what the user believes the code should be in the state really is the code that's in the state. So we do the verification of that. The user identity U is used for policies. So the contract may say, if Rom asks me, then I'll give him the right answer. If Vipin asks me, then I'll tell him that it's going to cost him 5 cents in order to do this. So, so the user identity is for policy. The channel identity is a key that is bound to this transaction that forces the submitter of the transaction to the distributed ledger to be the same submitter that gave the enclave the request. But the submission to the ledger is with a one-time key, so that there's no correlation between transactions. There's no way to correlate transactions to a same identity on the ledger. At least not based on the keys. You'd have to look at more network analysis if you were trying to do any kind of correlation for it. Then in order to verify the identities for the user and the channel, then we have two signatures that we're passing in there. So we sign the message by both the user identity and the channel identity, and the enclave can verify those, all of that. Okay. Questions on what goes into the invocation request?
The hash of the code itself, the contract code,
mm-hmm.
presumably that is already registered somehow with the enclave.
Yes. So when we do the registration of the contract, so when you create a contract, you're registering the policy that's associated with that contract. That policy includes things like what we were just talking about, the revocation pieces of it. It contains some information about what the replication strategy is and the availability of the state replication pieces. It contains the provisioning policy, what enclaves you're allowed to execute this on, and it also contains the hash of the code. So the actual agreement on the code has to happen out of band, but we're committing to what we agreed to. So if you want to verify that I'm not cheating you in the contract code, you can request the contract code. I hand you the code. You verify it, do whatever you think is necessary to make sure that you're comfortable with it. And then you can run the hash function on it and verify that what was committed in the policy is what I gave you.
Can you talk about what's a transaction and what's a method invocation a little bit more?
So let me go back up to 29 for that, just to make sure, right? So the contract participant is going to do an invocation to the contract enclave. So basically a request from the contract enclave, a computation be performed. So what's gonna go back to the contract participant is answers plus signature. I mean, this is the very simplified view. I'm not including any of the sort of proof code that goes along with this. The transaction then is basically, the transaction that goes to the ledger is, I have updated the state of this contract. The new state should be the authoritative state of the contract. That's basically what we're saying with the transaction is, commit this change for this contract.
And so at the end of the invocation, the state has already been updated in the contract enclaves?
Mm-hmm. The contract enclaves and the contract participant will have the update. But remember that state is totally separate from the ledger. We're not putting any state. All we're doing is saying this hash represents the current authoritative version of the state.
Okay.
Right. So storage of the state and everything is a totally separate process.
Okay. So even without the TEE, security issues for consistency, there needs to be some delay baked in because of the propagation delay between these elements for consistency. If some other party wants to do this,
Else wants to execute something on the contract, then they need to be able to grab the current version of the state and do it. Yes. And that's, when if you look down on the replication section, that's where we actually talk about how that happens.
Okay.
And again, I'll step out here and just say, back to Vipin's earlier question about what's the difference between sort of trustless and optimistic. So here's an optimization that we use in some of our contracts. which is, although I may have provisioned five enclaves, it's going to work a whole lot better if all of us agree that one particular contract enclave is the one where we're going to do all of our invocations, all of our committing invocations, because we can guarantee that that state, or we can't not guarantee, that's the wrong word. With high probability, if we're all playing by the rules, then that contract enclave is going to have the current version of state. So it allows us to do optimistic execution. We can continue executing even though we haven't committed the transactions, because that contract enclave has an implicit serialization of the updates for us. So if we have a little bit more trust, then we can architect the system in a way so that we can get even better performance for it. If we don't trust each other, like if somebody starts not playing by the rules that we kind of ad hoc agreed to and starts committing from someplace else, okay, the infrastructure will still manage it, but our performance is going to go down. That is, it's not going to compromise the integrity, but it is likely to compromise performance. So if we're all motivated to get high performance, and we're all motivated to do more or less the right thing, we just want to make sure that nobody does actually break the rules, then we can set it up and have this set of rules for how we're going to do this that allows us to get much better performance. So, and this is specifically back to your question about that propagation delay for state. If we're really operating in a trustless environment, you have to wait.
Right.
If we're operating in a semi-trustless environment, then you can say, take whatever, you know, you go to the same contract enclave I went to, because you know that it's got the most recent version of the state, and you just continue to execute.
So you're saying there's some kind of a caching happening as well, which
yes,
speeds it along.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Because of that, rather than just, you know, this is a trusted enclave, but it's a trusted enclave that holds this cache.
Yep, exactly.
That make it faster.
Yep. So we can work without the cache, right? And we will enforce the rules as though there were no cache in place. But the reality is that there's a cache here. And if we all kind of agree that we're going to play by the rules, we can take advantage of that cache to get a much better performance. And this is that notion of designing, you know, the protocols must be trustless, but we want to provide opportunities in our architecture and our protocols so that if it's not really trustless, then you can get really good performance. And what we have found is there are very, very few applications that are completely trustless. There are a lot where it's kind of you know, I just want to make sure you don't break the rules, but you're not likely to break the rules. And so we've tried to design the system so that you can get almost traditional server performance out of the executions that way.
But won't you achieve greater scaling by allowing some kind of horizontal scaling as well?
Let me be a little bit careful. Because the updates to a contract are serialized. So here's one big difference between us and Fabric, right? Which is a knock on our ability to have performance. Because the state is encrypted, being able to identify independent updates that could occur in parallel to a single contract is impossible. So in Fabric, if I have two keys in the sense of a key value store, key A has the value 5 associated with it, and key B has the value 6 associated with it, and one execution of the chain code increases the value of A by 1, and one increments the value of B by 1, those two updates can happen in parallel. There's no conflict, right? So the chain sets that are generated are independent of it. But because of the way we're doing the encryption on the try, on the Merkle try, we can't allow you to see that those two updates were independent of one another, because you can infer information about what just happened. So if you update A, even though an update to B would be independent, you have to operate, that update to B has to operate on the set, on the state where A has already been updated. So state has to be completely serialized.
And A and B are two information elements in the same object?
And A and B are two information elements in the same object. So the design principle is basically, look, if you've got things that are going to be updated independently, just put them in separate contracts. And you can build method bridges or message bridges between those two contracts in order to get the combined operations. So we tend to have far higher numbers of objects that are much more focused and small.
So
whereas with Fabric, you would have a much bigger database.
What mm-hmm. happened if you have contracts which deal with many, many objects at the same time and you want atomic operations on those objects?
Yep, many objects at the same time is actually what we're designed for. So you could do parallel updates on independent objects just fine. You just add more and more contract enclaves as long as you're provisioning. This goes back to Hart's comment about sharding, which is where I will say that Hart is right. It would be nice to be able to know that a particular contract enclave has 500 contracts running on it or provisioned for it while another one has three. And we don't support that yet.
He was also kind of against that whole stickiness principle where he was talking about randomization. Then of course the cache would be broken and then mm-hmm. you get more less performance.
Yep.
But it's always going to be some kind of detection of this sort of duplication. And anyway, this seems to be pointing towards some kind of a microservices type architecture where the objects that are being handled smaller and smaller.
Yeah. So there are a couple of very interesting things that you just said, Vipin. One is about the difference between randomization versus taking advantage of the cache. Hart is exactly right. If I have a trustless model, that is, if I really don't trust anyone and everyone's highly motivated to break it, then I want to do as much as I can to make sure that no single enclave can control this computation, right? And so I may require some notions or some ability for randomization of it. But my performance is going to suffer. You know, this is where I have to deal with synchronizing updates to state for it. If my trust model is more tolerant of risk, then I can do these performance optimizations. What we wanted with the PDO infrastructure was not to prescribe one or the other. We wanted to provide you with a mechanism so that you could adjust how you use the system based on what your risk tolerance is. You plus whatever the contract is that you're executing with. So we're not in the business of managing risk tolerance. But what we'll say is, if you are more tolerant of risk, you can architect it to go faster.
So make a quick time check. We're coming up on the hour. Sounds like we could use at least one more session.
Okay.
But what do you think?
I'm happy to do it. I got the slides all put together. This gave me an excuse to actually put it all into a single deck. So
awesome. Rest of the crew, should we cut you on 2 weeks from now, which would bring us what?
I mean, sure, this is an interesting discussion. I don't see why not.
Okay, so then let's continue on 26th.
Works for me.
All right, because Mick, the main questions I still have hanging on my head are, is the contract now, if I'm doing complex operation on multiple objects, how do you keep, does that mean all those objects need to be co-resident?
need to, or would they perform better if they were? Those are two different questions. And by the way, if you look down at slide 41, where I've got the Fair Exchange Protocol, uh-huh. I mean, what you can see is five different objects. One is a pool of red marbles. There are two pools of red marbles, two pools of blue marbles, and an exchange object that manages it. And the CCL is designed to manage the dependencies. That exchange will work much better if we perform all of those operations on a single contract enclave.
Okay.
It will perform correctly if you don't.
Great. So maybe we'll start with correctness next time around, and you can use this flow to kind of, then it'll kind of
okay.
If you walk through this, it might clarify things.
Okay. Good enough.
Thank you, sir. Awesome. Uh-huh.
Thank you.
All right. Stop share.
Thanks, Mick.
Uh-huh. Sounds good.